Chatla. So I'm going to ask my question in Tibetan, so that I'm going to request Astrologer Londila to translate my question so that it could be more clear that I want to ask for. Ani tanda kela tanda or Richard lagi tanda anzo kawashishtwa. Tig nalolia tanda anzo mi tedu nalolia self-compassion sejerwa. Tig kawa nalo tsudure sejer. Ani I have two very important question. I think ani kela di kushi tanda
niwa di jelsin.
So the question was, you talk about four pillars of well-being. Four pillars of well-being. So where does self-compassion fit in?
Self-compassion is part of connection. It's really connecting to oneself. Self-compassion is very much a part of the connection pillar. Yeah. So thank you for that.
Hi. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it, Professor. And
can you talk into the mic?
Yes, sorry. I have a question about the cases in particular. You cite that there were 38. Is there an electroencephalogram in the process of, like, these hours? Or I don't know if I'm explaining the proper
thing. During the tukdam. Mm. Yes. We have recorded EEG or electroencephalography, and we actually published an initial paper on EEG, and basically the bad news is that we don't see anything in the EEG. However, it's very important to appreciate that, as I mentioned, we were not able in any of the cases to look at EEG changes in the first 24 hours. I believe that we're more likely to see something if we are able to measure the EEG in the first 24 hours. But we can say now with a lot of authority that after 24 hours, the EEG is flat.
Another one related. Oh.
It's one question.
Tashidhar, Professor, I have a very broad question actually. Has there been any study which, sees the similarities between deep trance states across cultures, like in the Balinese and deep hypnosis, and also our Tibetan meditation? Has there been anything which finds the similarities?
Yeah, there have been a number of studies, including work in our laboratory, that have looked at different types of meditation and also the similarities and differences between meditation and other related states like hypnosis. And there are a few things to say. One is that there probably are some similarities in terms of attentional features, but there are really important differences as well. They are definitely not all the same. I can assure you of that with a lot of authority. And so we know, for example, even strictly within the Tibetan tradition, that meditating on compassion is completely different in terms of its brain state than analytic meditation that's focused on emptiness. Totally different.
Thank you, sir, for the insightful talk. I wanted to ask regarding the first part of your talk, which was on the four pillars of well-being. So as per your findings, I believe you have found some connection of our well-being with awareness, mindfulness, with four of those pillars, connection, insight, and purpose, which is very much mentioned in our medical system. And I have a curiosity that this such kind of information, which is with hardcore scientists like you and your team, will this be available to the common mainstream health system? How do you find any possibility or likeliness of this kind of very insightful information getting up to the mainstream health system?
Yes, thank you so much for that question. We would love for this information to filter into the mainstream health sector. In the United States, we're doing a lot of work with healthcare and bringing these four pillars of well-being into healthcare. We have a very simple questionnaire that measures the four pillars of well-being and takes about 2 minutes to complete. And one thing that we would be very happy to do is to share it with you. You can translate it into Tibetan and use it in your ongoing medical work, and it may provide some interesting insights. You can give it to a person when they first see you, and you can see what are this person's areas of strength, that is, which pillars of well-being are high and which are lower, pillars that may need to be strengthened. That would be something that I think would be very, very interesting to explore. And we'd be very happy to send this measure and have you translate it.
Thank you so much for the wonderful talk. I'm just curious to understand your understanding or how you define mind as a neuroscientist. So how do you understand mind?
How do I define mind? That as a neuroscientist, that's a very challenging question. I will tell you how most neuroscientists define it, and then I'll share how I would define it. Most neuroscientists would say that mind is an emergent property of the brain. So what do we mean by that? Well, mind arises from the brain, they would say, and therefore it is wholly dependent upon the brain. So mainstream neuroscience would strongly argue that there is really no such thing as mind without brain, that you need brain for mind to manifest. My view is a little bit more nuanced. This view of mainstream neuroscience, I would argue, is more of a belief than it is a fact. It's not a fact. It's really a conjecture, a belief. It's a worldview. There is a problem in neuroscience that we often refer to as the hard problem. So what is the hard problem? The hard problem is, how does experience arise from the material matter of the brain? And my strong belief is that we as scientists have not made any progress on that question in the last 100 years. We are no closer today to understanding that than we were 100 years ago. And so my view is more agnostic. I don't know. This is an area where we're pushing up against the limits of our science. And I think it's healthy to suspend our beliefs and to not prematurely judge the nature of reality. There are many people I know who I consider to be extremely thoughtful and wise, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who have very different beliefs about the mind. And so I do everything I can to rest in this not knowing. And I try to train my students to do the same.
Sorry, Richard. Recently, in the case of the Lama Losang Shenpila, Geshe Dorje La, so the team, the Thubten team, they have found that the Lama, his hair was grown a little longer in the investigation. So can I have the scientific reasons behind that happened?
Yeah. I have no idea. I do not know. And so these phenomena are extremely interesting. I believe the first thing we need to do is to carefully document them using rigorous methods. And then we need to start thinking about how that might occur. One thing that we believe is likely is that there is a certain subtle kind of metabolic activity that can continue to occur after the heart has stopped and the person has stopped breathing. We know, for example, that animals who are hibernating, they can hibernate for the whole winter and they stop breathing during hibernation. And they're able to exist in this very subtle kind of state. And so I actually think that there are physiological mechanisms of hibernation that may be relevant to understanding some of the changes in Thubten. So there are some parallels in the biological world, but we really do not understand this at this point in time.
Oh, hi. So my question is more related with the Tibetan medicine kind of connection. Where or which of the dissolutions of the body and the process of dying is the one that is getting longer? Are these bodies not getting into the process, or what's like in there? I kind of don't have it clear.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question. I'm not sure I can shed much light on it, but one of the things that seems clear is that there is the initial dissolution of the sense modalities. So seeing, hearing, touching, taste, smell, all the senses shut down. And that may actually help to increase the signal, if you will, from the mind, because there's less distraction from the senses. The preservation of the body that I was referring to earlier, we don't know what the mechanisms for that are at all. It does suggest that there are continued metabolic changes that seem to be playing some role in this that can extend over, in certain cases, quite a long period of time. But again, we have not been able to take any tissue samples. So one thing that we've talked about for the future is the possibility of obtaining buccal swabs from the inside of the cheek. These cells can actually be extracted, and we can extract DNA from these cells, and we can look at epigenetics and do all kinds of really sophisticated analyses. So at some point in the future, we hope to be able to collect some of these biological samples, which would potentially provide us with a new window on what may be occurring.
Good afternoon, and Jashi Dile Dorola. My question is regarding the four pillars of well-being that you have given us talk. And from your experience, in which pillars of well-being do you think that our mentally challenged or ill or mentally unstable person should work more? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. And in our understanding, and there's a lot of evidence for this, no single pillar is associated with mental disturbance. All four of the pillars could be. And it really depends on the more precise aspect of the mental disturbance. And it suggests that strengthening all four pillars can be helpful in decreasing mental disturbance. But we know, for example, that anxiety and depression can be associated with increased distractibility, which would be part of the awareness pillar. It can be associated with extreme loneliness. That would be part of the connection pillar. It could be associated with a reified sense of self. That would be associated with the insight pillar. And it could be associated with a lack of purpose in life. That would be associated with the purpose pillar. So all four of these pillars contribute to mental challenges, just as all four contribute to our well-being. So it's not any single pillar. Similarly, the quality of resilience, which is so important, we have evidence to suggest that every one of these pillars contributes to resilience. Resilience does not belong, if you will, to any one pillar. It belongs to all four.
So we'll have the last question.
Professor Lal, I have a very difficult question to ask you. The point is, that about 20 years back when we were studying, prior to neuroplasticity, it was a given that once you are mentally sick, you are sick. You got a label that you are a depressive or you are a psychotic, something like that. Even after so much research, practice in biomedical parameters, no, they still continue with the old antidepressants, which have so many side effects, antipsychotics and everything. While the core of your research shows something very positive, you know, something which we can look forward with hope. How can we change this system? That is my question.
Yeah, I share your view completely. The system needs to change, and it's slowly changing. As the scientific evidence becomes more and more compelling, as you say very correctly, there are serious side effects of the kind of medications like antidepressants and antipsychotic medication, and there are other strategies to train the mind. And this is where the dialogue between science and Buddhism is so important. And so we have demonstrated, along with other scientists, that when we train the mind, our brains change. And in fact, I'll put it a little bit more specifically. We can see more specific changes in the brain through training the mind than through any drug that you can take. More specific changes. When you take a medication like an SSRI, an antidepressant, or an antipsychotic, it's like blasting the brain in its entirety. And so it's a very general effect. We can see a much more specific effect with mind training. And so it's our aspiration that as the scientific research gets more and more compelling, we will see a shift, and we are seeing a shift. We're seeing a shift, I know, in the United States and in other parts of the world as well, as the scientific evidence becomes more compelling. So thank you all so much, and I really appreciate this opportunity and the great questions. Thank you.